Okay, so my name is Maggie Whittam and I'm 35 years old. Today is July 4th, 2017, and I'm speaking with John Whittam, who is my father. And today we are recording this interview at the homestead in Steamboat Springs, Colorado on Claddy Lane. Okay, so Dad, first off, what is your birthday?
November 27th, 1931, as I tell the pharmacist every time I pick up medicine.
So you were born in the midst of the Great Depression.
Right.
But I understand your family was more well off, so that didn't affect you much as a little kid.
Let's see. My father was a great worker bee, you would call him. And he, I think, decided early in life that he was going to be a success in the world and make money. And I think he probably had very definite opinions about the woman he should marry. I mean, not that he had picked her out at all, but he was an engineer who graduated from MIT in 1922, but it was just everybody was going to be an engineer in the 1920s, and the market was overcrowded, and he switched to a rising company, and very fortunately, I think, in the insurance. And became a claims adjuster in a company that had started maybe 10 years before and which is now a very successful institution, Liberty Mutual Insurance. So he was in Richmond, Virginia. He was stationed there for a while and he met the sister of my mother and found out they came from a good, solid Southern family, and I think he liked that. He appreciated a lot of the South, the stability and the pride and so on. And he made a point of visiting my aunt's sister in Danville, Virginia. And she was the youngest of four surviving children. And so he made a point of courting her down there, and 1928 proposed, and so they were married, and soon after my brother was born, and then I was born, and then there was a miscarriage, and my sister was born 5 years after me. So I had two siblings, and I was born in Atlanta, where he was stationed at the time, and then he moved to suburb of Boston, where he stationed for another 2 years, and then to the Philadelphia suburb. And for the rest of his life, he worked there, commuting into the city every day, first by train and later by car. And when my mother had her third child, her mother in Danville, Virginia, who had lived a fairly wealthy life, having her husband was a banker and one of the town's leading citizens, suggested that having three children was a load on any woman, and that she could hire a black girl in Danville and send her up to Philadelphia and become the nursemaid and maid for cook and so on for the household. And I would say that sort of gave our family an advantage in the sense that we had a servant living in the house for almost 10 years, from 1936 to 1946, basically.
What was her name?
Her name was Martha, and I've written a story about her. And it's in my book. somewhat beyond the middle class. Because most of my friends, teenage friends, didn't have servants in the house. I can't remember of anyone who did, but I'm probably mistaken.
So
having a black servant was unusual. So I went to public school all my 12 years in the suburb of Philadelphia, a very stable community of people who, almost all of them, not all of them, but most of them, commuted to the city for their livelihood and then maintained a house in the suburbs where there was space and lawns and take care of, and it's not crowded like the city was. So that's the way I grew up, and I was a half hour ride by train into the city. And as I grew older, I found the musical entertainment, classical music entertainment, very refined. And I went to the Academy of Music many, many times for listening to the orchestra play or opera or whatever. And I also took music lessons, got to be fairly proficient in the piano, had 6 years of training. My father played the piano very well, and my brother played the trumpet, and my mother had played the violin, although she didn't continue very much. So we were, music was a big part of our life, because my father played almost every night he came home, and played for 15 minutes, half hour on the piano, and the house was always full of music. We had a phonograph very early, and I say music was a big part of our life. He was very fond of Gilbert and Sullivan Operetta and sentimental songs. I've written a story about that too, I guess. So grade school I got through, and high school I remember vividly. I can still remember the teachers' names. They had their last reunion of my class, I don't know, just a few years ago. I didn't go, but I did go to the 40th and the 60th reunions. I went back to Pennsylvania, not for them, but, well, I guess for the 40th I did, and the 60th I was going to be there anyway. So high school was a big deal, and I didn't excel in athletics, but I was a good student, and studied Latin for 4 years. It was still required 2 years of Latin. It was being phased out, I think. For anyone who continued into the third year, it was very, very unusual. My brother hated it, and I loved it. And I also studied, I was good at math and other subjects, so. And drama, I like being in drama, taking minor parts generally. But I bicycled all over the county, a thing you can't do in that town anymore, because bicycling is dangerous on those narrow roads. The roads haven't been widened much. So my nephew and niece grew up without bicycles because it was considered too hazardous. But I remember exploring quarries and Valley Forge Park, and that was my mode of transportation. I also got into the chicken business in the war, and we raised chickens in the upstairs of our garage, because of the food shortage, and that was a big part of my life from up until the 11th grade. And I would sell eggs and chickens to customers who appreciated the freshness of the eggs, which were very expensive in the stores. Not all food, but food was rationed, much of it. So that provided me an opportunity to have my own little chicken business.
How much was the carton of eggs?
12 eggs was about 60 cents. But they were very good eggs. They were fresh. Not like what you find today. Well, you actually have to pay for, what are they now? $4.50 for a half dozen. At least what were supposedly fresh eggs, class A. So those were unusual features of my teenage life, I would say, having my own business being very close to Philadelphia, which was a huge city, and yet living in the countryside.
Would you deliver people's eggs to their door on your bike?
Yes. Well, I had a cart, which I'd carry behind me. It was a two-wheel cart, and I would put maybe 6-8 dozen eggs in it, and a live chicken if I was, or not a live chicken, but one that I had killed, and dressed for whatever customer, and go across town, maybe at least a mile. 2 miles altogether.
So you would slaughter your own chickens?
Yes.
Who taught you how to do that?
My father showed me how. I didn't like it at first. Eventually I got used to it, cutting their heads off and plucking them and draining them and cleaning them up afterwards. I don't think I sold very many, maybe one or two a week, something like that, even if that much. In certain seasons of the years, they were, I can't even remember when they were most prolific. But it was something that set me apart from the neighborhood, or not neighborhood, but what my friends were doing.
What was the experience of the rations like? Like, you could only go to the supermarket and buy XYZ?
Yeah, we had coupons. And butter and sugar, I think, were very limited, and we could only buy a certain amount of it. We could only buy a certain amount of gasoline, unless we families who were doctors who had to travel around that got more gasoline than we did. But we just had one car, and my mother would drive my father to the station, the railroad station, every morning, and then come back and fix breakfast for us, because he went in very early for us kids, the three of us.
So this house in Wayne, can you describe it to me, the first floor, second floor?
Well, we had five different houses in Wayne itself as our family expanded. But the last one that we had were the largest, where I was finished my high school, and my family was there until the mid-50s, or early 60s. So they bought it in 1943, I'd say. The market was low. Property values were very low. He was very lucky to get such a big house at whatever price he paid. The war was constantly in our face. I remember that December 7th, 1941, when my father came home, and found the Japanese had invaded or bombed Pearl Harbor, and he was just mad as hell. And we had air raid practices for the next 4 years. We even isolated parts of the house so we could leave the lights on and have them not shine through the windows. And we kept a map, I guess, of the European and Asiatic theaters of war, and I had little pins to show the flags of the Nazis, or the Japanese, or the Russians, or the Brits on this map, and would move them around as the D-Day invasion occurred. And so I was very interested in that, and geography. So it all seems like a lost period of time now. People don't know what I'm talking about.
There's so much plenty now, it's hard to imagine rationing.
Yes. But it gave us a taste of what it was like. And my father was very generous, and immediately after the war, he was very internationally minded. He never went to Europe, never went outside this country as far as I know. We took in displaced persons, and we had a Russian couple, white Russian couple, living with us from 46 to maybe 49. They lived in the upper floor. We had three floors in the house. They were white Russians who had lived in Poland during the Red Regime of the Lenin Revolution. And when the war was over, of course, they couldn't go back to Russia, they couldn't stay in Poland because of their history. And we took them in, and they also had a sort of Russian families who associated with them, and they had a young child that, not their own child, but who often came to visit. So, and they acted as, I think he had a job. Yes, he had a job somewhere, and the woman, the mother, or the old woman, sort of helped my mother in the kitchen. We had there were three children only, and by this time our black maid had gone back to the South, but it was, we had a lot of company. My parents were game fanatics, and they loved bridge and card games in general, and my father was not much into poker, but he did teach me how to play. But they had tournaments in the house, and they'd have four card tables in the living room with you know, that'd be 16 people playing duplicate bridge. And then they, you know, two or three weeks later, they'd go to somebody else's house. And of course, my mother had to prepare refreshments for whenever that happened. My father was on the school board. We had many meetings in our house. He was also on various committees, and both of them were church members, and I was too, a very serious church member, until I was 15 anyway. I went to church every Sunday with them. I went to Bible school in the summer, and could quote verse and chapter of the Bible pretty easily. I've forgotten all of that now. But I was very much taken by the ministry, and we had a youth fellowship person who led teenagers around, and we visited Princeton Theological Seminary, where I thought I might go someday.
Why did the religion interest you so much?
It was part of life. The church was. Is that what you're asking me?
Just why it interested you. Why you thought you might be a priest.
Well, priest is sort of a unflattering word in our family, which is Protestant. I only learned to use the word priest sometimes for the Anglican or the Episcopalians who had priests, but ministers were in my family, my southern family, my grandmother and her other children were all staunch Presbyterians, and the Presbyterian Church in Wayne was a pretty large and influential community. It was only later when I realized that all that I'd been taught about Christianity was the businessman who went to church didn't pay much attention to. It was a social function, and I slowly became aware of that. You didn't necessarily bare your cheek to people who were out to kill you or compete against you. So all that sort of vanished away. I thought someday I'd be a missionary. this is when I'm 12, 13 years old. But by the time I was 15, I had disconnected with the church pretty much.
What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oddly enough, I think it was meatloaf. My mother was an excellent cook. She'd been trained in the South by the cooks in her mother's house. And she knew, and I think she learned a lot on her own, but baking bread, hot bread, was the earmark of her cooking, I would say. We had hot bread at least several times a week, dinner rolls that she made. I just remember when you and I were having dinner last night, I put the plates in the microwave because keeping the plates hot was always a big deal with my mother, and serving food onto a coal plate was just inconsiderate because the coal sapped up the warmth of the meat or whatever. So meals were quite formal. We always sat in the same places, in the same chairs, in the same positions. And my father always served my grandmother first. This is his mother, who lived with us until she was 90 almost, and was incontinent and demented and got worse and worse while she was with us. But she was always served first. And then my mother was served, and then my sister, the females were first. And then I was the youngest son, so I was served. And then my brother and my father, last of all, served himself. And always said the same blessing, or almost the same blessing, every night about how thankful we should be. So it was dinner was a formal occasion. And if the telephone rang during dinner, my mother really disapproved and let whoever was calling know it. But the telephone didn't ring very much.
What was your relationship with your brother like?
Antagonistic. He was bigger than I was. And he was a football player and beat me up all the time as a kid. And I would say it was until much later. Well, I think we were competitive all through our lives in one way or another. So it was not a healthy relationship, and he was in trouble so much of the time. He was misbehaving or out late beyond his curfew or a fire occurred at the high school and he was blamed for setting it and stuff like that. And I was always well behaved, I'd say. I mean, I never had a reputation of being pretty wild, and he was pretty wild. So,
how about with your sister?
My sister 5 years younger, and I liked her very much. I think a pretty wonderful relationship. But she, as she grew older, she developed troubles with her parents, I think. And I think she saw a counselor. And at that time, seeing a counselor or a psychiatrist was frowned upon. You didn't do that because that was a sign of weakness. And yet, she passed through that period and then really fell in love with a great guy and married and was, unfortunately, very happy for the 2 or 3 years of her marriage. And then she contracted this vicious cancer and died soon after at the age of 30. So that was a big blow to all of us.
What was your favorite subject when you were in high school?
Well, I certainly liked English. I was extraordinary in taking 4 years of Latin and 3 years of French. And I got to be pretty good in those. So, but I enjoyed all forms of learning. And I, when I went out of college, I was just so excited when I discovered William Faulkner in the first few months of English class at Williams College when I was 17 years old. I read this story called The Bear, which was the shortened version without the long part about the black history of the same family. And that just coming up, and I think Faulkner has remained my the greatest writer for me. I read almost everything he wrote, visited his grave and when he died in 62 in Oxford, Mississippi. That was with Dick Stratton. He and I made a car trip down there. So college was there were so many new things to learn. I was very excited about studying whatever it was, history, particularly European history was an eye-opener for me. So I was happy to advance. I did do pretty well in college for those years.
So your house in Wayne, can you tell me what it was like when you walked in the front door? What did you see?
Well, the front door was almost a living room, but it wasn't the real living room. It was a more or less reception area where we would, that's where the phonograph was, that's where the piano was. It was adjacent to the dining room and the real living room, which had a fireplace. There was a terrace outside, which you'd walk from the entryway all the way around to the back side of the house. And it was, we had a lot of room. On the third floor, we had a vacant room where I built a tureen. Which is the entire room, except where the door opened, and that's where the control was, and I had trains running around, electric trains. I shared a bathroom with my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was the one who couldn't keep things straight and sang these old hymns about Father, dear father, come home with thee now. The clock in this steeple strikes one. All these old temperance songs from the 1890s. And she was batty. Or ended up quite batty. At first, when she came to visit, to live with us in the 40s, she was kind of pleasant, and her rooms smelled of lavender and old furniture, and she liked, I think, us being children, but as we grew older and she grew soft in the head, she was a impediment to conversation, to activities. We always had to wonder, what are we going to do about Grandma when such and such happens? Or my parents were then, for vacation, they would go to the Jersey Shore and then later the Chesapeake Bay for weekends in the summertime. And finding somebody to stay with the grandma, or where we could take grandma off to stay with somebody else, was a real challenge.
So she wouldn't go to Rock Hall?
No. I can't actually remember where she was, but she did not know this. You might remember this is my mother's mother-in-law. And so that
did they get along?
Managed to. I think my mother deserved awards for it. But my father kept two on his bureau at home. He kept two portraits, one of his mother, one of his wife, my mother. And he honored her. Because he was an only child, and his father died before he was 1 year old. So he didn't grow up with any family. He had no siblings, and he's indebted to his mother raising him, and she did obviously the best she could. Sent him to military school, and he really liked the discipline, and when my brother got in trouble, he thought of sending him to military school, but that never happened. I don't think my brother would have allowed it to happen. If it was ever suggested to him, I think he would have fought it, and he probably was.
And what was his nickname?
Well, his nickname was Bucket. When he was about 8 years old, we lived in a different house, and I can't remember the story with the neighbor who remained a lifelong friend of him, but it had something to do with a metal bucket in the neighbor's yard, and I don't know. But he was known as Bucket for a long, long time. Longer than he would have liked, I think. And then when he went off to college, he shortened it to Buck. Dignified and masculine name, and Bucket.
He didn't want to be called Charles Harold?
Well, no, the name was... My father's name was Charles Harold Whittam, but Charles was the name of his dead uncle, and it was... given to him by his own father, who, as I said, died a year after he was born. And Harold is the name, his middle name was what my grandmother called him. But everybody who I knew from very early times called him Whit. W-H-I-T. Uncle Whit. Whereas my mother's many relatives. And so when my brother was born, he was named Charles Harold Whittam Jr. Well, he didn't like any of those names. He didn't like the junior part. He didn't like the Charles part. Harold was shortened to Hal. And he eventually discarded most of this.
Well, I think we'll continue this in another recording, but thank you for discussing your childhood with me. Oh, will you tell me one more story? When you found out that World War II was over, where were you?
I was in Rock Hall. We were staying at a boarding house, which is what and many families did that in those days. Because they wanted to take the onus of preparing meals off of the woman. Boarding houses were very common to spend weekends or weeks in for vacationing families from the suburbs, something like that. So this was in August of 45, of course, and I would have been just 14 or almost. And the old lady who ran the boarding house was the one who got the news first. She got in her station wagon and took the dinner bell and went all over town ringing the dinner bell. And I was with her along with, I can't remember who else was in the car, but it was jubilation, yes. Yes, finally over. And the 40s and 50s, well, the second part of the 40s and the 50s, you know, were an era of expansion and self-congratulation, and we'd won the war and established the United Nations. And it was a very positive period.
What about the scare about communism? That wasn't,
well,
hadn't
that
started
was there,
yet.
But I think it was a pretty distant threat. I never took it seriously, although certain people did. Well, I think McCarthy capitalized on that, the scare of, you know, private property being confiscated. And there was a large Communist Party in the United States at that time, but the United States has always been a very conservative country in my mind. So I thought it was an exaggerated way of scaring people into submission. And just like our present government, big scare most of the time, the way you manipulate minds. So I thought it was all exaggeration. And my father was worried that when I went off to college, I'd be indoctrinated by the leftist professors who dominate colleges. And he was very right-wing. Very Protestant and very Republican. All of his friends, he had a club in the down at Rock Hall, in his vacation home. They met every month, and there were 9 old men, you know, like the Supreme Court. And they were all Protestant and all Republican.
Okay. Well, thank you, and we'll continue this next time.